This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. There may be as many as 14 million people in the United States who suffer from an eating disorder. And if there's a profile of the sufferer, it's a skinny, white, young woman. But a true picture shows something far different. Black, white, or Hispanic, young or old, male and female, eating disorders affect far more people than we realize. And the true number of sufferers is nearly impossible to calculate. Cynthia Bulick hopes to change that. She's the director of the UNC Eating Disorders Program, and she's written a new book called Midlife Eating Disorders and is with us today in the studio. Cynthia, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
So tell us about this. Our view, perhaps our stereotypical image of the person suffering from an eating disorder, not very accurate.
Nope. Wrong. In fact, myth-busting is really at the root of why I wrote this book. Because I think if you say eating disorder to the vast majority of people, the person you just described is what they're going to conjure up. But that's not who walks through the door seeking treatment.
And are the disorders the ones that would come to mind? Anorexia, bulimia, that's essentially it?
Well, I think most people know about anorexia and bulimia. But as you may know, the American Psychiatric Association is putting out sort of their new catalog of psychiatric disorders, the DSM-5, in May. And we got a new disorder on the block, and that's binge eating disorder. And what it is it's the presence of binge eating, which is eating an unusually large amount of food in a short period of time and feeling out of control. That's the key that differentiates it from just overeating. But in the absence of those purging behaviors that we see with bulimia nervosa, what's interesting about it is binge eating disorder is the most prevalent eating disorder in the United States. So we're looking at about 3.5% of women and 2% of men who have binge eating disorder.
Of all men and all women, 2 and 3.5%. Is it a new disorder or new to us?
It's officially new. It's been around unofficially for a long time. And in fact, you know, binge eating was first described in the 50s by Mickey Stunkard. So we know the behavior was there. But in order to get disorderhood, to become official, you have to actually undergo a lot of research. And there has been so much research in the past decade just saying, yes, this is a bona fide disorder that deserves to be in the Bible.
And tell us now again about the profile. We were wrong about who it was. So who can have a disorder? And are they proportionately a portion? I mean, are there some people who are or some groups who are more likely than others?
Right. Well, you know, interestingly, we do see one little protective effect. So there's some suggestion that being African-American might be protective against developing anorexia nervosa. And whether that's due to genes or whether that's due to the fact that the African-American community really sort of has a broader acceptance of body shapes and sizes, we're not sure yet. But when we look at those other two disorders, when we look at bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder, we don't see that sort of protective factor at all. If anything, we might be seeing more binge eating disorder in the African American and the Hispanic population than in the white population.
And men and women as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I think for a long time we've heard this, you know, disproportionate, more women than men have anorexia and bulimia. To some extent, that is true. For binge eating disorder, it's not so true. It's much closer. And in fact, I don't even trust those data for anorexia and bulimia because we define these disorders based on what we saw in women. So we're not necessarily asking the right questions to get at the symptoms that men might experience.
Well, how would that be different? I mean, yeah, please tell us about how it might be different for men.
So, for example, when we think about anorexia in women, we think about a drive for thinness. But that's not always what guys are after. Guys might be after sort of a drive for being buff or a drive for being lean or having that elusive six-pack or 12-pack. So what they're aiming for might not be captured in the language that we use to describe the disorders.
But they're still starving themselves.
They're still starving themselves or they're using supplements or they're exercising excessively and really behaving in a disordered way.
When we're doing this, is it all based on body image or mostly based on body image?
You know, interestingly, the binge eating disorder criteria don't even have a body image component, which a lot of people are concerned about because they think that there should be. But at the root of this, my starting point is acknowledging that there's a genetic component to eating disorders. And, you know, part of it is that genetic component is there. But there are often environmental triggers that sort of unleash that underlying genetic predisposition. what we're seeing now is more of those triggers that are hitting in midlife. And I think that's why we're starting to see more cases of midlife eating disorders.
Yeah, well, tell us about that, because we didn't talk about the fact that this does affect people who are older than we thought.
Well, that's right. We're even seeing eating disorders in nursing homes. So we're seeing people who, you know, abuse laxatives in nursing homes, not for regularity, but for weight loss purposes. So this goes well into the 70s, 80s, and beyond. So really what we're seeing now is over 50% of the people who are coming into our program are over the age of 35. And that's light years away from that stereotype right. that you talked about in the beginning.
Over 50% over 35. Mm-hmm. Wow. So talk more about this genetic component, because it seems from an adaptive point of view, something about modern life and that gene can't be a disordered gene. It has to be the way life and this probably very useful gene at one time are coming together.
Right. Well, first thing is it's not just one gene. In fact, we're probably talking about hundreds of genes that work together in concert. So it's more like what your genetic dose is that determines how at risk you are for an eating disorder. And, you know, those haven't necessarily changed because it takes a long time for the genome to change. But the environmental context in which those genes express themselves have changed dramatically. So what we're seeing in terms of midlife triggers is people are saying things like divorce, empty nest, interestingly, retirement. And one of the things that we haven't seen so much, but is really critical now, are financial pressures in midlife. You know, now more than ever, people are facing financial challenges that they didn't expect when they planned their life. And that can be something that can trigger some of the behaviors that are the first step down the path to disordered eating.
And so what are those behaviors?
Well, one of them can be actually emotional eating. So emotions are often a trigger for binge eating. And if you're genetically predisposed, you go through a tumultuous situation like a divorce, the loss of a spouse, you might find yourself eating in response to those emotions, or stressed because of financial situations. So that can sort of be the trigger for that underlying predisposition to binge eating.
Anything about culture, food, nurturing cultures, for instance, if you come from that culture in which grandma always gave you some soup or said, eat, 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 as a way of saying I love you, does that make you more disposed?
Yeah, I think that's one of those myths, but I've never seen any data to suggest that. If anything, you know, having a wonderful, warm, loving family that eats together might be somewhat protective. But you can't protect just by having family meals. You know, there are all sorts of societal triggers out there. And one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking about is big industry. You know, big industry basically has changed their advertising techniques. It used to be sort of keeping up with the Joneses. You know, you see the nice Chevy and you're like, I want one of those Chevys too. But they've switched it and it's become more insidious. And what they're trying to do is get us off kilter and dislike ourselves. They make us dislike how we look. They make us dislike our size. And they make us dislike the aging process. And then they market these products or these surgeries that are like, hey, I can make you feel better about yourself if you buy this or if you undergo this procedure. But they're mind worms. And what that does is it just bores in and makes you completely dissatisfied. And that, too, can be a trigger for disorder.
So they kind of pathologize the human condition, right? I mean, what is normal for all of us or should be normal turns out that we can put you within a much more narrow limit and hate yourself.
Exactly. And all these shoulds are attached to it. You shouldn't age, or you should continue to look young. You should get liposuction, as if something's wrong with us if we don't do it.
But now talk about this pathologizing of the human condition. Then as we expand DSM and other definitions of disorders, I mean, does that in any way play into it?
Well, I think one of the criticisms about binge eating disorder is that, you know, does it really deserve a place in the book? Bottom line is, it deserves a place in the book. And the reason it does is what I don't think people talk about enough is there is considerable distress associated with this. There are people out there who binge eat. They feel that sense of out of control. They feel horrible after a binge. They get down on themselves. They feel guilty. And they're really trapped in a cycle. And they have not been recognized. They've not been able to get insurance coverage. They've not been able to get therapy. Many of them didn't even know they had a problem. So if you have a distressing condition and your life is impaired because of it, it absolutely deserves a place in the book.
So it seems that the rise in the number can be associated with the stresses of modern life. And the more stressful it gets, particularly those economic stresses, as they continue to bear on more and more people, the problems get worse. But my question is, since that sounds intuitive, I'm going to ask, have these problems always been with us, or are eating disorders really associated with modern life?
It's a great question. And unfortunately, we have very little data to guide that answer. One of the things that we don't have is epidemiology or population studies over time that really tell us how the numbers are changing across these different populations. So part of this is a call for action to get more of those data so we really can keep track on whether things are becoming more common or whether we're just recognizing them better.
And I'm guessing that now that we have more discretionary power over food, that where food is not as dear as it once was, as difficult to come by, anything that we have discretion over can easily become a disorder, I would think, in the human condition.
And just to plant this, a lot of the foods that are out there now, we are not biologically programmed to resist. So if you have these high-fat, high-sugar foods in large quantities, our bodies are not made to put the stop on consuming them. So it's almost, pardon the pun, but it's feeding into the development of eating disorders.
Oh, a lot of money goes into figuring out ways to trick your system into eating more and not know it's full. Foods are actually designed that way.
Yes, and when you hear about the machine that figures out what the perfect crunch point is for a chip, it's like, wow, they've got technology that I wish I had in order to stop some of these behaviors.
And we're spending more on fast food these days than on higher education.
Right. That is one of the saddest statistics.
That's an amazing thing. So what do we do about it? Do you start with the disorder, or do you look at these underlying conditions? Where do you start?
It's not an either or. We got to do both at the same time. We really do have to go after the industries, and we have to fight back with our pocketbooks, not buy this stuff, resist those mind worms, and just get them out of your head. But if you have a problem, that doesn't mean don't seek help. The most important thing is just to get an evaluation. Have a professional cast his or her eye over you, get an eval, and then make a recommendation. Whether you go in through a dietitian or a social worker or your pastor or your primary care physician or a psychologist, it doesn't matter. Just get that first evaluation.
Are there some pretty good therapies for working people through this?
There are. You know, for binge eating disorder and bulimia nervosa, cognitive behavioral therapy really is still the treatment of choice. And this is a therapy that really looks at the thoughts that you have that develop and maintain those unhealthy eating behaviors. Medication can play a role, but it doesn't give you those long-term skills to keep the behaviors under control. With anorexia nervosa, the bottom line is food is still the best first-line medication. Being renourished is step one in the treatment of anorexia nervosa.
When you talk about industry, that seems to me a much thornier question, because you get into questions of free speech. You can't really limit what people say and how they advertise. So it really is the burden seems to be on us, or can we say, you know, put limits on the way marketers advertise?
Well, I'm just thinking about Mayor Bloomberg right now. You know, he's trying. And, you know, I think those sorts of efforts are really well placed, and we need more of them. They're bold efforts, and they meet a lot of resistance, but that doesn't mean we should stop trying, because there really isn't any reason why someone should ever buy 72 ounces of a soft drink.
It scares me. I tell you what, Cindy, it really does scare me when you say that, because you'll start with reducing the sugar and stop lying to us about our bodies and telling us that we're awful people if we're not that slim. And the next thing you know, they're going to say, and by the way, this radio show you just did on drones, I don't want to hear that again. That really is polluting the public mind. And so we're next.
Well, you know, I think free speech goes in both ways. You know, they're free to advertise the way they want, but we're free to absolutely say, I don't want this in my ears. I don't want this in my kid's head. You know, out of my living room, out of my radio.
Are there campaigns like that to really educate consumers and understand, you know, how we're being pushed around by this industry, which is very, very, very effective and very powerful?
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing is when we do it as a group, we have a lot more power. The National Eating Disorders Association has a media watchdog group. And whenever you hear something that really is along these lines that is offensive and create these kind of mind worms, we get a bunch of people together, we post it up on the Need a Watchdog website, and we've had some success in turning things around.
Like what?
Yoplait turned some things around. So they did one of these calorie math advertisements, where it's, you know, how much you expend, how much you take in, and, you know, if you have your little yogurt, then your calorie math comes out on the right end. And they took it away because we said that promotes disordered eating thinking. You know, so I think this is what we need to do. Lots of people respond. People respond and act.
Particularly when it becomes that kind of pressure and then they voluntarily step back. So are the treatments different now that we know this spans ages and ethnicities and gender? Does it vary from person to person, type to type?
We have work to do. And most of the treatments that have been developed for that stereotypical patient. So, for example, right now, we developed a treatment for older people who have anorexia nervosa called UCAN, which is Uniting Couples in the Treatment of Anorexia Nervosa. What we're doing, we know that bringing the family in for adolescents helps. If you're 50 and you have anorexia, you can't necessarily bring mom and dad into your therapy session with you. So we're bringing the partners in. So we're doing couple-based cognitive behavioral therapy of the patient and the partner, and they're working together toward recovery. So it's a way of leveraging the power of the family, but in a developmentally appropriate way.
What about schools? Do they play a role in this?
I think we need to actually use schools more. In fact, a law was just passed in Virginia yesterday, I believe, that is really looking at screening and reporting in schools. So part of this is schools, even universities and medical schools, are afraid of eating disorders. It is easier for teachers to express concern about alcohol use, depression, cutting, substance use than it is to ask someone about an eating disorder.
Why is that?
There's something that is just more of a barrier about talking about something related to weight. Weight is this electric thing. The bottom line is eating disorders aren't about weight. You can't tell by looking at someone whether they have an eating disorder. I always say eating disorders come in small, medium, and large. You know, and again, that's that stereotype of anorexia as the eating disorder.
Cynthia, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Cynthia Bulick, director of the UNC Eating Disorders Program. Her new book is called Midlife Eating Disorders, and you can find out more by going to cynthiabulick.com. You spell Bulick, B-U-L-I-K. That's the State of Things for today. Thanks for listening. Our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell and Isaac Davey Aronson, along with Sean Wen. Alex Granados is our director. Christina Blyde, our intern. Robin Copley, the technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.